conversation over the phone, and I'm with Gloria Braim, and I'm so happy that you're with me tonight.
Oh, yeah? Why is that, Stephen?
Oh, because I read about you for so many years and admired your work. You are the author of a very well-known book, Different Loving, which deals with BDSM. You're also a therapist. You're a poet. You're an author of fiction as well. And you have, well, I have to say, you have one of the, I think, one of the greatest blogs of all, deep in your blog, which is deep inside your oversex mind.
Well, it's just inside the mind.
Inside.
But, I don't let anyone get too deep inside the mind, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think it's wonderful. It's just there's a lot of great content on there.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate that.
And I was happy to provide you with a small little contribution there.
Indeed. And I thank you for that.
Oh.
I like to keep it fresh and current and exciting and fun, and I try to cover every aspect of anything related to sex that I can find, from straightest of the straight and sexual health news, all the way to my wild opinions and fantasies. So.
Yes, and actually, you also have really great comments and commentary, because you made a comment on Sexy Prime, which is Susan Crane Bakos's blog, who's also a very good friend of mine and who has been on the show a few times. And you were commenting on...
Well, she had made a comment, rather she had blogged about a recent study that said women were more likely to cheat than men. This is a new statistic in the new world, in the 21st century, as opposed to, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago. And she was just asking if people were surprised by the statistic, and clearly I was not. So I gather that's what you're referring to. My feeling is that female sexuality has long been oppressed, and that as society relaxes and there are fewer patriarchal strictures on female sexual conduct, that you're going to see women be increasingly in control of their sexuality, and I believe increasingly explore it freely. So,
oh well, I'm
does
also
that summarize
that,
it?
I totally agree with you on that. I think there's long been this power structure and this control thing, and through religion and maybe other type of groups as well, that has perpetrated.
Yes, our mothers.
Yeah.
Our mothers and our fathers, you know, and the lessons that have been passed down through the generations on, you know, the traditional ideas of what femininity is supposed to be, rather than, from my point of view, a realistic model of what it actually is. You know, I think the evidence has always been there that women are highly sexual, and yet I'm kind of old, so even when I was growing up, I mean, you know, the perception was that girls didn't really like sex, or sex was really about the man, and I think that was awfully convenient for men, but I don't think it was realistic in the least.
No, absolutely not. How did you break through all that?
Break through all of what? All of the traditional programming and the background noise of culture and all of that?
Yes.
Well, ironically, one of the things I often said is I've always been relieved that my parents never, you know, were too shy and uptight to ever talk to me about sex. Because I think if they had, it would have just destroyed everything, you know. By having to get all my own information and being kind of a nerdy person, therefore reading and trying to read good material, source materials and stuff like that, I think I was able to independently form a lot of my own ideas about many different things. And I did grow up Jewish, liberal, hippie in New York, so, and lived through free love and all of that kind of stuff. And so I would say that, you know, even my own ideas about sexuality have evolved, but I just never seem to have the same hang-ups that other people had even when I was 13 and 14. So, you know, to me, I think once I got over the incredible shock of finding out that, you know, my father screwed my mother, you know, that was like, when I found that out at age 10, I was so grossed, you know, and that everything after that just didn't seem so bad, you know, it all just seemed of a piece, you know, gay, bisexual, whatever, you know, nothing was as bad as that first shock, so, you know.
Well, that's great. So then, actually, their non-communication to you actually was to your benefit.
I like to think it was to my benefit. And I will also say that my parents were very liberal and egalitarian. So I never had the sense growing up that there were things you couldn't do because you were a girl.
Oh.
You know, or that there was, that I was expected, for example, to grow up. Even though my parents did expect it, I really didn't realize they expected it until I was almost 20, and it was too late, but I was not raised to believe that my purpose in life would be, for example, to be a mother or to support a man or play a secondary role to a man. I was definitely encouraged to think for myself and not to be afraid of having controversial opinions about things, so that undoubtedly contributed a lot to it. So as I formed different ideas about politics and society and culture, sex was just in the mix with that. And I was a voracious reader.
Well,
you know.
that helps.
Yeah.
Reading, intelligence, the intellect, that helps to, especially when you don't get so much of that, that guilt stuff.
Until later, no.
and I guess you never had that type of religious thing that screws so many people up.
No, I was raised as an atheist.
Oh, interesting.
My parents they're both gone now, but my parents were, as I like to put it, devout atheists. So there was never any of the religious overlay of God doesn't want you to do that or God is watching you or, you know, God thinks it's bad. But, you know, they were limited in their own way because they were, you know, and on one hand they were sort of progressive because they had a more European attitude. They were European, had a more European attitude, which is to say a slightly more mature attitude about sex in general, you know, but at the same time were Victorian. They were a bunch old. They had me late in life, so they were a bunch older. And so they just never discussed it. And I was quite surprised when I first had my real sit-down with my parents, I think in my 20s, and, you know, my mother mentioned how, you know, Dr. Ruth was a filth monger. <You know? laughs> That just was like, really? I thought she was amazing. So, you know, it was funny.
Yeah, absolutely. It's wow. That's... I'm just so amazed how that all happens to people and how they do acquire that stuff and then also how they don't acquire it and how they can then deprogram themselves.
Well, and I matured young and I started to be sexually active really young.
Ah.
So I was sexually active when I was 14.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Things that people would get thrown in the pokey for today.
Yes, it was quite different back then.
It was completely different back then. I mean, no one would have ever imagined that, you know, even a 19 or a 20-year-old having a relationship with a 14-year-old was something that could send you to jail.
Oh, yeah, now forget about it.
Maybe in the South, but not in New York, you know. Yeah, not in Brooklyn.
Isn't it strange, though, how, I mean... Well, what do you What do you think of that now?
About how I, you mean my, the sexual freedom I had to explore when I was a kid?
Yes.
I regret that. Well, I'm of two minds. One mind is that because we raise our kids to be so scared of sex, for a lot of kids, I believe it genuinely is traumatic.
Mm.
You know, I think, for example, in this culture, I mean, rape is not only a traumatic event, for example, but it's quadruply traumatic in this culture for people because we do make people feel so dirty and horrible about sex.
Yes.
And it fills them with so many conflicted emotions. So I think if you have a society where children are not as uptight, or teenagers are not as uptight or fearful or guilty about it or repressed about it or think that it's just such a horrible thing even to be inappropriately touched, for example, whatever we call it, that these days it really is traumatic and you really, I don't think there's anything healthy at all about adults having relationships with kids, particularly in the present culture. At the time when I was being raised, it really wasn't like that. There wasn't that same kind of fear, and there weren't as many rules, and there wasn't as much hysteria. So to me, it did not feel injurious. And to a kid today, maybe it would. I don't know.
So it's really, society's attitudes.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think they have a huge, they play a huge role in how the individual perceives themselves. You know, so when you had a society as we had in the 50s and 60s, or early 60s particularly, where a woman felt, for example, if she slept with one, more than one man, she was a tramp in everyone's eyes or a slut in everyone's eyes, or if she slept with a man outside of marriage, she was a horrible person, women really suffered over that. Today, I think many young women feel, I don't want to settle down with a guy until I've had sex with a few of them, so I know what I like, or I know I'm compatible. You know, it's the culture. Nothing biologically has shifted, but it's a different social expectation of what's permissible and, you know, what you're going to be punished for and what you can get away with. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. How did you first get involved with BDSM?
Well, I think I'm kind of a textbook sadomasochist. That's how I identify. I identify as a sadomasochist. And I identify as a sadomasochist because I like kinky sex, and that's what gets me off. And vanilla sex is sweet, but not all that arousing to me. And I was always interested. I mean, I can't remember a time in my life, even when I was a kid and even and certainly when I was a teenager, when those weren't my sexual fantasies and I wasn't experimenting with them privately. The real issue was doing it with somebody else, and there I was very shy about it and picked up from the culture that it was very wrong and took a women's studies class where I read Desaad and Story of O, and oh my God, everybody was hysterical over it, and it was just the worst thing in the world, and blah, 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 and I was very feministic, and I was afraid of it, because I really didn't understand it. But nonetheless, it was my private sexuality, and when I could, with a boyfriend, we would explore some of it. And people kept dropping comments to me about, you know, and people always wanted to have people I didn't know so much would want to have kinky relationships with me, and I'd be like, nah, not me, you know. That was, you know, because it felt too naked and exposed, and I think a real turning point was late in my 20s when, oddly enough, I got onto I got online before there was an internet. I got on a BBS in the mid-80s, and through the, how shall I put it, the guidance, the depraved assistance of a girlfriend was introduced to a BDSM group, and I still was unsure whether I fit in with them or where I placed, because I never really had extreme fantasies about extreme pain. My fantasies when I was younger, tended to be more fetishistic in nature. But once I joined this group and started, you know, expressing some of my own fantasies for the first time, I was amazed that there were all these people who found him so exciting and that there was this enormous sexual compatibility with people I'd never even met or knew nothing about, and I was just so aroused by it, frankly. You know, and realizing how arousing it was to me, how exciting, how freeing, I realized this was me, and I guess it took me a year to sort of wrap my mind around it, but I began going to clubs and started to meet more people, and I think I felt the way anybody who belongs to a, fractionalized, marginalized sexual group feels, whether you're gay or a swinger or poly, which is, you know, you meet a group of people, they share your interests, and you feel like you've come home on some very fundamental level.
Right.
So that was it. And I haven't looked back. That was 1985.
Wow. So that was already good 24 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Yeah. So there you go. I mean, it was the first time I felt completely sexually happy and comfortable. So I often think of my experience very much, you know, the way I often think, you know, gay people who've been closeted must feel, you know, which is, you know, even if they can function with a straight partner when they have gay sex for the first time, it's like, oh my God, this is what I've been missing my whole life, you know. So that's how I felt.
Now, do you consider yourself polyamorous? Or do you like that word?
I'm fine with polyamorous. I am, by nature, a non-monogamous person. I never felt that sexuality was... I feel that sex is like any other part of life. If you're a social person, you probably want to do it with friends. If you're not a social person, you know, or you have moments where it's more fun to do it by yourself, but, you know, I didn't see the taint in it, and as I say, I, you know, don't consider myself, never have felt very monogamous, like that's something I can only have with my partner for it to feel meaningful. Not at all. I think sex is fun, so I guess I consider myself polyamorous. But on the other hand, I'm not, you know, I can't say I'm not a swinger.
Right.
In other words, I don't vigorously seek out experiences. But if I meet someone and I'm attracted to him and I think he's hot and he wants to have sex with me, or at least submit to me,
ah,
I'm game.
Yeah.
Aha!
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 Yes, mistress.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a really good definition of what the difference is between polyamory and swinging. But I always like to hear people's own definitions and their own thoughts about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think they're very similar in many ways. I think they share a similar spirit in terms of an openness towards adventure and experience and a welcoming and friendly attitude towards sexuality as a natural and lovely part of life. But I do think that there are, you know, small differences. I always feel that people should unite across their differences to work for sexual freedom together.
Yes.
So I'm pro-swinger in the sense that I believe every adult is entitled to choose their own sexual destiny. But I'm not quite a swinger myself.
Wow, good. What do you see then, if you look across the board, what do you see as, for lack of a better term, let's say the greatest problems we have right now sexually in the culture?
In the culture, in American culture?
Yeah, yes.
I think it's the same problem that we see in the political culture, which is that there is a conservative old guard that resists change, even when the change makes sense. Even when the change makes a lot more sense than what's been going, than the status quo. It's just the notion of change frightens them. The notion of doing anything differently from the way they think it's been done or the way they think their parents did it. Whereas, I'm an extremely progressive person. I believe that, the key in life is always figuring out if something doesn't work, finding a new way to do it so that you're happier.
Yeah.
And clearly, sexuality in America, sexuality really, I guess universally, I can't think of a single country where I could strongly recommend their attitude towards sexuality, because each country has its own taboos and strictures, and laws, and that's the real problem. One thing I'm very, I would say probably the biggest problem in America to me is the increasing criminalization of normal human sexual behaviors. Rather than dealing, and the biggest problem in the courts, the selective prosecution of sex crimes. In other words, some people can do whatever they like in this world and not be penalized, and other people, because of their socioeconomic bracket or whether they can afford the right attorney or more often than not, whether they're male or female, whether they're come from a moneyed class or are perceived as not having money, that often dictates, or whether they're a disliked minority. For example, the government will go after or has traditionally gone after people whose sexuality they simply don't like. They'll close down an S&M club or they'll close down a tranny bar for no particular reason, then they really don't like that group of people. I mean, that's obviously what led to Stonewall in the first place, was the constant targeting of gay people for absolutely no fucking reason. Just because the cops didn't like them and they therefore start scrutinizing every aspect of their behavior. And, the same thing could be going on at another bar two blocks away, and the cops won't care, but because it's happening in this group of people who are viewed suspiciously because of their orientation, they'll be prosecuted. So those are my chief issues, I would say, and the things I find most worrisome. Because I feel that at any time, particularly those of us who are kinky or, again, in sexuality that I wouldn't call minority sexuality, but I'd say groups who've been marginalized, in other words, people who were considered different because we like to screw different people in bed or like to do it in a different way or don't get our orgasms from vaginal penetration but from shoe worship or whatever, that we're viewed as disreputable characters who need to be watched, So that really bothers me. That bothers me a lot.
Yeah, it seems like it's hard to almost to relax when and enjoy when you have to always be thinking about, well, is that knock going to come now tonight? The knock on the door going to come?
Right. Or, I feel, one of the great things about some of the sexual openness that has resulted from the internet is that people do feel much freer to go out and do all kinds of wild things that they might not have done 10 or 20 years ago or in the pre-internet days.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think quite a few of them are living in a fool's paradise, because what they don't realize is that a lot of the laws have not changed. So it's at the whim of your local DA whether or not you might be arrested for something that, you did all last year, but tonight when you show up at the club, somebody has ants in his pants to look good for his conservative constituents and affects the big bust of an establishment that has been operating for 2 years. So I think from my perspective as an activist, you know, the real focus of activism should be on trying to get some of those laws changed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like people
the laws really trail the mores. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
That there seems to be that there's not that same kind of activism that there was in the late 60s and the early 70s. People seem to believe that they have won, which is true to a certain extent, but as you say right now, you know, that could change simply on somebody's whim.
Absolutely.
And I think that there should be more, there should be some more activism. There should be more people standing up and organizing and, you know, and just, you know, like getting them out of people's personal lives.
You know, we are taught that sex is not or should not be that important. I mean, as a therapist, I have couples come to me and say, well, you know, I love my partner to death, but, you know, we haven't had sex in X number of years, but then sex shouldn't, you know, sex is not that important. But the reason that they're seeing me is because they're going crazy because they haven't had a sex life. You know,
right.
They're miserable, they're depressed, they have health issues, or they have mental issues, or their marriage is fragile, or their relationship is fragile. Because you may wish to believe that sex isn't that important, but it is. I mean, it's a fundamental component, I believe, of personal happiness, and I believe it is a fundamental aspect of human identity that you can't separate it out. But with this great pressure in the world to believe that sex is not that important or shouldn't be that important to serious-minded people, I think it's very difficult for people, except for an oppressed minority, say, like gay people, circa Stonewall, to really feel the passion to finally fight for their rights. And I think an awful lot of people feel, well, you know, nobody even knows the kind of sex I'm having. I have a hookup with this one or a hookup with that one, or I go to a club and I feel like I'm in a safe space, and I don't want anybody knowing what I do because sex is still dirty, you know?
That's, I just have to say that's really sad.
It is what it is.
Yeah, it's a sad commentary on our society and everything. I can totally see that, and I think that's, you know, what we try and do with Sexy Spirits. We try to give people alternatives, show them something a different way.
I love your radio series. I have to listen to your archives, yeah.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I mean, I really believe this kind of work is crucial. I think many famous heroes of the sexual revolution, if you will, I mean, you know, like Betty Dodson. I mean, there are a lot of people who may not even know her, but, you know, the fact that they're having orgasms, they really might be owing to people like Betty. Or
yeah.
Annie Sprinkle, you know what I mean? People who've actually gone out there and done a lot of radical things that maybe don't get noticed by the majority of Americans, but whose impact is nonetheless so great that they really have altered sexuality in America and enabled people, whether they realize it or not. It's kind of like the fight you have, you know, when people, you know, when you talk to young women and they say, I don't believe in feminism, and, you know, there they are in the jobs they never would have had for feminism,
right.
Living on their own rather than with their parents, something that never would have happened before feminism, being able to sleep around with men without being called a slut, something that never would have happened without feminism, you know, and then they say they don't believe in feminism, and, you know, do you laugh or cry, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have such a short, not just a short attention span, but we also have a very short memory.
I don't think it's the memory that's the problem. I think it's the, again, the hardcore group of people who are terrified of change, all of whom I would love to have in my office to help them deal with, to deal with that little problem and get over it already, you know. I mean, I believe that, you know, life is change and change is life, and to buck change or sit around and cry over change is almost to miss the entire point of life.
Absolutely.
You know.
Well, speaking of Betty, I've always said to Betty, you know, you should get a dollar for every vibrator that's sold.
No kidding. You know, because she and, I mean, and even, you know, I made a reference earlier to Dr. Ruth, not, you know, I'm not going to say that I'm like, you know, her biggest fan or anything, but in the 1980s when I first heard her show, when her show first came on the air in New York,
yeah,
it was so radical. Nobody was talking about sex. Nobody was talking about blowjobs on the air. You know, if they did, it was always in a very masculist context. Any kind of open sexual conversation, if it occurred, came from a man. If it came from a woman, everyone thought she was a slut. So to have a grown adult woman be able to speak about sex in a completely open, non-judgmental way, to me was, you know, and there were many women, you know, a whole group of them. To me, they were, you know, stars. You know, they were
absolutely
lights in the heaven. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so I guess, you know, And why didn't more people listen to them? I have no idea.
That's a very good thought. I think what happened was there was, and I know I had read about this somewhere, a certain advance was made, but to go completely radical, as some of those early thinkers wanted to go, I think that the vast majority of people just couldn't go that far or didn't want to go that far. It's like, all right, I want to be liberated to this extent. I want to be able to, you know, compete with a man, make the same money, have the job. But I don't want to go that far because one day I may want to have a baby. One day I may want to quit work. I don't want to go that far. And I think sometimes it's something like that, or, you know, just that there's just so far that certain people can go, and then they can't, and then it snaps back.
Well, I think part of that is because they're afraid.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, and I think they're afraid in part out of ignorance, because I think a lot of people feel like, oh, if you give in to your true sexual feelings, you're going to spiral out of control and, you know,
yes,
end up with leprosy in the back alley or something, you know, like something out of Somerset Maugham, you know, I don't know.
Right.
You know, but I also think that there really has been, you know, a certain amount of institutionalized evil at work.
Yes.
Because I do believe, for example, I mean, it just amazes me that someone like Kinsey, when the movie came out, you really saw it all over again, you know, that he is still being vilified. The poor man's been dead, what, 40 years?
Yes.
You know, he's still being vilified. He's still being looked at with tremendous suspicion. And really, the work he did was fantastic.
Absolutely.
And incredibly important. He was, to my mind, the first sexologist who actually observed sexual behaviors dispassionately and without judgment, you know, as opposed to someone like a Sigmund Freud, who judged sex by a completely Victorian standard, so that anything that was in any way removed from what I call the reproductive standard, which is male on top, missionary position, vaginal penetration sex, was viewed with tremendous, you know, suspicion as a sin.
Yeah.
And a lot of scientists actually labeled it sick because Judeo-Christian belief said it was a sin, you know. And then Kinsey came along, and he didn't have that bias. He didn't look at sexual behavior based on was it sinful or not, what did the Bible say. He looked at it as a scientist would look at it, which is, of course, the correct way, I believe, to look at it. He looked at it from a dispassionate point of view, and he merely observed it and noted, this is what people do, this is how people do it. And to my mind, it was one of the first genuinely honest reports of sexuality that we ever had. And for that, he was persecuted into the grave.
Yes.
Some of his work was suppressed. And to this day, he is vilified and doubted. So, you know, and he didn't have the normal inhibitions that most people did, and he had far more courage than the ordinary person has. So what chance does an ordinary person have? Every message they get from the culture is, don't go there, don't do that, it's sinful, it's wrong. You know, I think that those of us, and I do think there are tens of thousands of us now who are sexually progressive and liberal, you know, I think we are still at the frontier, and that the mainstream still has a long way to go.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a really great book that came out in the early 90s called The Anatomy of Sex and Power. It really delves into that.
Mm-hmm. Who wrote it?
Michael Hutchinson, who wrote the,
okay.
wrote the book on floating.
Okay.
And really just
Thank
talks,
you.
It's a really fantastic book, and that really talks all about this and how... you know, it's sex and power.
Yeah. I'm big on just, you mentioned that I'm a poet, so I mean, I try to tie it into my poetic vision, too, which is that, you know, there's a value in just simply telling the truth about things.
Yeah.
There's a value in just being honest. And most of what you hear about non-totally mainstream sex over the years has been, at best, fudged and quite often simply deliberately lied about.
Yes.
So I think the biggest challenge and really the proper job for most sexologists these days is simply just to tell the truth about sex and keep repeating it.
Absolutely. I just think that's... Such a challenge, and I think it's a great that we have people like you helping people.
Well, thank you. I try.
Oh, I think you do more than that. I think the books you have written have been so powerful and wonderful, and also your fiction as well.
Well, thanks. I'm not that great with compliments, so. Thank you.
I like what you said about to you, these people were stars. That's absolutely, that's how I felt when, you know, when I first came into this environment, when I first started working for Sex Youth Barrett. And I, you know, I had seen Betty Dodson on television, but to actually to meet her, talk to her, to exchange emails with her, you know, it's like, wow.
And isn't it kind of sad in a way that, you know, when you meet somebody, and I know this because, I mean, people seem to feel this way about me, too, you know, now, you know, that, oh, my God, it's so refreshing to meet somebody who feels good about sex, you know, or who can speak about it without getting all shy and, you know, doesn't have to lower her voice and, you know, and say, sex, you know, and any of that kind of stuff, you know, I mean, that... Or that somebody feels empowered to explore their sexuality on their own terms, that we still think that that's such a brave act.
Yes.
You know, I would love it, you know, I mean, to me it's no braver than, you know, brushing your teeth in the morning. I mean, it's just a part of life. You know, why shouldn't you know what you like in bed? Good God, you know what kind of ice cream you like. Why shouldn't you know what feels good? You know, why shouldn't you be connected to your whole body? You know, a lot of people, I think they're aware of their body down to their belly button, and then from their thighs to their toes. You can ask them about, you know, how is your toe today? And they, you know, a woman, and she can tell you in detail, but you know, vagina, you know, doesn't really exist. It's down there.
Down there. What was the name of that great publishing company, Down There Press?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, do you ever think that if it did become that accepted, that not that we need taboos to keep things spicy, but what do you think of that train of thought?
Well, we always will need certain taboos.
Right.
You know, some might even argue, and particularly S&Mers might argue, that it's the, you know, the shattering of or transcendence of a taboo that actually can make sex even sexier.
Ooh.
And there will always be certain taboos, and for good reason. Some taboos are in place to genuinely ensure that we stay in pretty good health.
Right.
For example, I mean, there are certain things you can do in bed that could get you pretty sick, you know. But I would like to see a readjustment of our taboos. For example, I'd like to see unsafe sex become taboo. How's that?
Ooh.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
You know, rather than, let's say, multi-partners being taboo. Why should that be taboo? That's a very normal and healthful human behavior. Multiple orgasms, great. Wonderful for the mind, wonderful for the spirit, and lots of health benefits to it, too. You know, we have the proof that being sexually vibrant and having a lot of orgasms usually results in people leading longer, healthier, more cardiovascularly fit lives. So why not? I think taboos should exist to keep people healthy.
Yeah.
But short of that, where do so many of these taboos come from? I think, again, because people are so uptight about sex and find it so difficult to be open about sex or talk about their own needs or desires or fantasies, even to the person they're permanently partnered with quite often, you know, they don't, by the same token, they don't question some of the so-called common wisdom, which usually amount to fishwives' tales, you know, about sex.
Right, and, well, there's a great documentary called Pornography, The Secret History of Western Civilization.
Right, it's wonderful.
Oh, so you've seen that one?
Mm-hmm.
Well, did you remember this scene with Lassie Braun, the great European director? He says, if you listen to them, you will understand. They just don't want people to have sex. And then he says,
yeah, you know, there are a lot of people out there who just don't want other people to have fun.
Yeah.
In general. They just don't like that idea. And usually they're the people who are not having a lot of fun.
Right.
And they don't like the idea that other people are enjoying life more than they are. They take it.
And of course, it's also a very Reichian idea, the idea that fear is the basis of control.
Absolutely.
And it's a,
and Reich did a lot of great work, too, earlier on.
Yeah. Well, I guess before he started cloud bursting.
Well, yeah, the cloud bursting and maybe the Oregon box. I'm not so sure. But he was a very important sexual thinker with very progressive ideas, and yet another example of somebody who was tortured by the government for holding unconventional sexual ideas. So it was Margaret Sanger.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, she was repeatedly jailed for birth control.
Right. She was hounded by Mr. Comstock.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Who
Which goes back to my
to
earlier beef about the selective prosecution, because You know, you could have an enemy of sex come out and say a whole bunch of stuff that's complete crap, that's just patent lies about sexuality or about homosexuality, and there's no punishment for them, and no one tries to shut them up, and no one denies them their free speech to spew sheer ignorance or propaganda. But people who dare speak a truth which does not coincide with or support the existing institutional opinion, and they will be persecuted. So it's a large problem. Which I kind of don't imagine will be resolved in my lifetime, but, you know, one must work for the future.
Yes, I think that's a very, very important point and a very important part that people should do.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly would like to see it happen.
So how do you feel about the fact that I'm a BDSMer?
Well, I think it's great. I mean, I have to say that I never really had that much personal experience with that prior to starting to work for Sexy Spirits. However, mm-hmm. once I started going there, we did quite a few demos down at Paddles.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there quite a few times. I've also gone there to see their own demonstrations, other people's demos other than the ones
mm-hmm.
that we have done. I'm very good friends with Steven Spiliotis, the erotic photographer, the bondage photographer, who
mm-hmm.
I will say for the 100th time who did my photo.
Thank you. Oh, the one where you look so hot?
Oh, thank you. Well, now you just made my day.
uh-huh.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, I like when you said about Babelicious.
Babelicious, yes.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And it was just really, you know, they are the most intelligent people, the nicest people who I've met, not at all what you think, what the public would think. And everything is done on the up and up. Everything is consensual. Everything is explained. So I very much support it. I like seeing that there are places where people can go where they can play and where they can play so openly, where it doesn't have to be this deep, dark secret, you know, stuff like that. So I like seeing
mm-hmm.
I like these things becoming more mainstream. I like seeing these walls being torn down. I don't like the fact that there's still so much of this nonsense going on because, you know, I'm still human. I'm still going through this stuff too. So I like to see, you know, the more and more, information that can come out, the more stuff that can be torn down. I'm all for it.
Well, good. Me too.
And I always find a correspondence of intelligence and intellect. Always, there is that sexual freedom there.
Well, I think there's a little more sexual maturity.
Yes.
I tend to believe that, you know, because I believe that, you know, you know, that inequality, you know, universal equality of sorts. I tend to feel that, you know, if you hang around long enough, you're probably bound to meet just as many dopey people as you will smart people, just as you'll meet poor people and rich people and people with class and people who are skanky. And, you know, because I believe we're just a regular cross-section of Americans. I don't believe that we are necessarily a special minority or that it's only the best of the best who do it. Maybe the people who will stop and discuss it with you in an articulate way are some of the more interesting and entertaining people. But I feel, you know, it's a huge community. It's much larger than what you see at the clubs. In fact,
oh, yeah.
I think that probably the majority of people who are kinky, meaning people who have fetishes, people who want to swing or whatever it might be, you may not even ever see them at a club because not everybody hooks into the club scene. You have a lot of people who are doing this quietly, pursuing it just because it's what turns them on, and they may never be part of the community, and you don't even know who they are. You know, one of the interesting things about being down, I live in Georgia now, is that, you know, when you go to a party here, it self-selects for a different socioeconomic stratus. You know, when you're in a rural part of the state where I am, you know, it's not necessarily going to be all doctors and lawyers. It's going to be plenty of farmers and truck drivers too.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's everybody. It's everybody. And I feel, you know, even by, I don't like to emphasize, you know, that we're more intelligent than other people, because I think the point really should be that we're just human beings. It just so happens that we get off a different way,
yeah,
which is BFD, you know. We get off a different way. And who's to say how somebody would get off if they didn't believe that they're only allowed to have sex in one particular way? I think the shame of it is that not enough people ever give themselves permission to find out what really works for them in bed, or to form a relationship with somebody who can give them what they really need and want in bed.
Ooh.
How's that?
I think that's really great. I think it's just, it's inspiring, I think, because, you know, you really only live once.
And, you know, to me, the Delphic Oracle said it all, know thyself.
Yes.
You know, how can you really grow to be a full person? How can you really fulfill your potential if there is one important piece of your identity and, you know, that you either keep in a closet or refuse to deal with or walk around feeling unhappy with? You know, I know for a fact that, you know, people who are really sexually unhappy are really unhappy in life. Not achieving what they could be achieving, not forming the kinds of relationships they could be forming, not experiencing the love they could be experiencing, not receiving the affirmation that we all need from other people. You know, and to me, that's just deeply sad. And something I know can be changed if they'll take the risk of changing.
Absolutely. It's just, you know, it's just hearing that, I think it's so important to hear it, and, you know, I'm really glad that you're here tonight and that you said it.
Well, thank you. I talk a lot.
Well, it is important. It's important to say. It's important to hear it. I'm just, you know.
You know,
glad.
It's the oldest lessons in Western civilization. Know thyself and be true to thyself.
Yes.
That's it. You know, and why when you're in bed? I mean, to me, this has always been really odd. You know, why when you're in bed, if something feels good, would you stop somebody? Or say, I'm not going to do that. Oh, that feels, you know, why? I don't want to feel that good.
Yeah.
I don't want to know who I am. I don't want to listen to my body when my body tells me this feels good or that feels bad. You know, it's just irrational to me.
It is. I think perhaps it's people, you know, they just have this pleasure phobia built in them, and they don't know how to dislodge it.
Well, and I think that is the burden of social repression and this concept that, you know, one of the, you know, you mentioned my blog, which is called Gloria's Oversexed Mind, and I've had a number of people say, you're not oversexed, you know. And, I mean, I just picked that name because I thought it was funny, you know, and because I do think about sex an awful lot of the time. I also think about my puppies and my aquariums and my garden and, you know, and the books that I read. But I do spend a lot of time thinking about sex, but I agree. I don't think there really can be such a thing as oversexed. I don't think there can be such a thing as having too much fun either, you know? The limits should always be what's healthy, you know? And that is, again, a very individualistic thing. I think probably one of the biggest problems with sex is that people seem to believe that in that one area of life, you know, you can have as many different food preferences and food allergies, and, you know, there's 17,000 kinds of toothpaste and shaving creams and bath soaps and all the rest of it, so we know that people love variety and everybody likes something different. But wait, when it comes to sex, you're all supposed to do it one way.
Well, I think it's because we're still sold this soulmate thing. We're still sold that thing over and over again, and people are still trying so desperately to find that, and, you know, they're looking in vain.
Well, I think people, I have two permanent partners, and I feel they're both my soulmates, I guess, if you want to use that term. I mean, I feel a closeness with them that surpasses all other closenesses. How's that?
Yeah.
But I think the sad part is that even when people do find love and romance with someone, they're still afraid to reveal themselves. And I think it's because they're ashamed of who they are sexually. And I think that we still, even though we're in the 21st century, are still lugging around a 19th century concept and 19th century models of what people are supposed to be like. And, you know, I question those models because I think they were kind of quack to begin with.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. I think that they are more than quack.
I mean, you know that until the early 1960s, if you were caught masturbating, you could be sent to a psychiatrist as having a mental problem.
Yeah.
And could be diagnosed that way. You know, so we are so, I mean, you know, and where did that notion come from? It came from the Bible and the notion that, you know, onanism is a bad thing.
Yes.
Right?
And that's,
it has
and
no
that
basis
has
in science.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There were many, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Well, you go ahead. I'll be polite.
Well, we see even like you said, even in science, even in medicine, they wrote so many treatises about that, about how it's bad, how it's wrong. Oh, you're going to lose your energy. Oh, you're going to lose your this. And even from...
you're going to go blind. You're going to grow hair on your palms. You're going to blah, blah, blah. And it was all lies.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's, again, you know, as I had said earlier, what's really sad is those kinds of lies always will be published. And simple truths about sex, like orgasms are great and they're great for you and here's how you can have them. And, you know, if you're with somebody and you're not that sexually compatible or the chemistry's off, maybe you should try being with somebody else. And that's
right.
Okay, too. And, you know, maybe if you don't get off on penetration, so what? You know, there was a study done some years ago saying something like 30% of all Americans are sexually dysfunctional. And in my book, Come Hither, one of the things I say is maybe people aren't sexually dysfunctional. Maybe the problem is that they don't really like vanilla sex.
Right.
If they were allowed to explore something else, or if they were allowed to explore their gay feelings, their bi feelings, their swing feelings, their fetish feelings, maybe they wouldn't be dysfunctional at all. Maybe they'd be coming like a racehorse, you know?
Absolutely. Well, absolutely.
You know,
well,
I mean, in this culture,
from my own personal experience, I would say that in the last 10, 12, 15 years, I've become quite a devotee to outer course.
I completely understand.
that I just feel I can achieve everything the tantric people talk about with that particular practice, but I cannot achieve that with intercourse, especially with a condom on.
Yeah, and why not? I mean, what's really important in all these health studies, they always make it sound like you have to be having intercourse. The reality is what's really important to the human organism is orgasm.
Yeah.
By any means. It doesn't matter how you have your orgasm. You get all the benefits of the, you know, the aerobic workout, the little burning, you know, burning off a few calories, the wonderful chemicals that your brain releases post-orgasm, you know, all of that kind of stuff that's very helpful, that's good for the male, particularly for the male reproductive system. It's very nice for your plumbing to keep operating throughout your life. It will defer or possibly prevent prostate issues, you know. And all that really counts is that you have orgasms. And it's amazing how many people do not have orgasms at all. And I think one of the reasons is because they feel that their repertoire must be limited to a very specific and small set of sex acts that never will give them that complete pleasure that maybe outer course brings to you, or, you know, cross-dressing brings to somebody else, or whatever it may be.
So know thyself and know thy orgasm.
Absolutely.
And then follow that orgasm.
Absolutely. I think it isn't just, you know, for the pleasure principle. I think it's also, you know, just a realistic point of view to have in life, because another big problem that people often come in with is, you know, they depend, you know, all sex for a lot of people depends on the performance of the penis.
Yes.
If the penis isn't up to rock hard penetration, they don't have sex. And I say, what? Be prepared. You know, there are times in men's lives, at every stage of a man's life, when he's not going to be able to perform that way. What else can you do together? Or maybe you're going to get old and your back hurts and you can't get into uncomfortable positions. What else can you do together? You know, again, I feel it's very much part of, you know, the old way of thinking about sexuality, that everything has always been so, as I call it, phallocentric, or in plain English, penis-based, you know. And, you know, that's fine for those who've got them, but it's actually far more normal and far more typical for male sexual performance to ebb and flow throughout his life, just as female sexual performance ebbs and flows according to estrogen cycles. You know, that's the normal biological pattern for all people. And if you think you can only have sex one way, you're probably going to miss out on a lot of orgasms.
And I would say, as someone who has a penis, that the phallic-centric model, it hasn't been the greatest for me in my life, and I think for a lot of people also.
It's a lot of pressure on men.
Yeah.
I think that there are a lot of women who defer responsibility for knowing what turns them on to men. You know, women who've never had an orgasm, and then they're with a guy, and they expect him to know how to give it to them. I always feel if you don't know what turns you on and you don't know your own body, it's probably going to be very hard to be satisfied by somebody else.
Right, and it's like you know, we are not mind readers. could you tell me?
You're not.
No, we're not mind readers.
Mm-hmm. I know, you know.
It's just really, again, you know, people, hey, find out and then communicate. That's the Pali word, principle, communicate. But everybody else, I think that's something that is very important.
And relax.
Yes.
Just relax. for God's sakes, you know, everything we do, presumably, whatever we do, even the most hardcore, scary-looking S&M, what the reason people are doing it is because it makes them feel good.
Yes.
Because it makes them feel happy, or it makes them feel complete. You know, this is not, you know, a serious, difficult enterprise. If you feel that it is, something's wrong. You know, it should be fun. It should make you smile. Maybe not in the middle of your scream, you know, but afterwards, you know, it should be a relief. It should be something you approach with energy and enthusiasm and an optimism, you know. And I feel sad for people who, and I see them and I see their suffering all the time, you know, are scared of sex or worried what it'll say about them or worried if they tell people what they like or, you know, or get really uptight about it, you know. To me, as a therapist, you know, the healthiest person is the person who feels vibrant in their sexuality. And horny. Horny is good.
Horny is alive.
Horny is alive and awake.
Yeah. And present. I want to thank you so much for being my guest tonight.
Well, thank you. This was so much fun.
It is. And I really just want to tell you, I'm everything that you said tonight was really powerful and really meant a lot to me.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I'm really glad. I guess you and I have to keep talking.
Absolutely.
Privately, if not on the
Absolutely.
Radio.
I would love to have you come on the show again. And
thank you. I'd love to.
Absolutely.
This was a very fun way to spend a Saturday evening.
Yes.
Thank you.
That was a wonderful first conversation, and I hope the...
I'll look forward to more.
Me too.
Okay. Next time I'm in New York, I'm visiting you.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, please.
Right.
And we would love to have you do a lecture, have you do an evening presentation.
Okay.
And I would just to meet you.
Okay. I'm shorter in person than I am on the internet. Just warning you.
Oh, that's no. You're a star in my eyes.
Aww. Well, thank you, Stephen. You know how to talk to a dominatrix.
Yes.
well, I look forward
sure,
to it.
I'll make sure I'll be looking up. I will be looking upwards towards you.
Well, we know what that means.
Yeah.
A kneeling position. Okay.
Well, thank you so much again. And
you're very welcome.
Visit Gloria's different websites. The main one is GloriaBrame.com.
The main one is GloriaBrame.com. My blog is typepad.com/GloriaBrame.
And
you
really
can find me on Facebook. I'm very friendly, so, and
yes,
I post
yes,
a lot of content there
her.
Too.
On Facebook and also on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, I'm even on MySpace, though I seldom go there. Yeah. So I'm very easy to find.
Seth just wrote that he wants you to have your own show here.
Pardon me?
Seth, our engineer, said he just sent me an instant message. I want her to have a show here on BBS.
I'm pretty easy. Sad but true. We'll talk.
Absolutely.
I'm laid back kind of person. And I live in you know, in the middle of the thick woods of rural Georgia, so there's not a whole lot to do here. You know what I mean.
Well, we definitely got you to get you back up to your old hometown.
Well, thank you. I'll be there eventually.
Cool. Great. Well, thank you again so much.
Are we done?
Yes.
I will bid you a fond a biento. Until the next time.
You too.
Okay.
Until then.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Gloria. And thank everyone for listening tonight. We will return next week for more Aunt Mondo Eros. This is Stephen Otero speaking. Thank you, and good evening.